Hi, this is Mike Boich with Bud Colligan, Pod Summit on Entrepreneurship and Innovation. We're here for part two of our interview with Jensen Huang, CEO at NVIDIA. Jensen co-founded NVIDIA in 1993 to bring 3D to personal computer users. 13 years later, NVIDIA employs 2,700 people and just finished a fiscal year in which they achieved revenues of $2.4 billion and net income of over $300 million. In addition to becoming one of the two dominant players in PC graphics, they designed the silicon for the original Xbox and are currently doing the graphics processor for Sony's PlayStation 3. In part one, we talked a little bit about the early days at NVIDIA. In this segment, we'll talk with Jensen about the state of the market and how his job has changed as NVIDIA has scaled to become a multi-billion dollar company.
Why don't we shift tacks now and start talking about the industry now and the opportunities. If you were starting a semiconductor company today, scratch, what areas would you focus on and what do you think are some of the real exciting things that are happening out there?
Well, I think that the most exciting and the most relevant part of semiconductor innovation today is at that intersection between computing and consumer electronics. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we're very focused. You know, the reason why computing, of course, is because computing technology enables software. And most of the rich experiences that we need today and we want today require software.
Yeah.
And unless you have a computing platform to start, whether it's an iPod or PlayStation 3, or you know, you need to have a computing platform as a starting base so that you could develop rich software and rich services on top of it. That is the intersection that we're focused on, and I think that's where the exciting things will happen. There's a lot of new types of experiences that we can imagine people having, whether it's, you know, of course, Apple and their iPod was a beginning. But now you could just extrapolate that basic idea into all kinds of applications, whether it's in your car or on your cell phone or, you know, just all of these kind of rich services, software-enabled, computing platform-enabled experiences are going to be made possible in the coming years. I don't know if it's worthwhile to create companies at this point around there. I haven't really thought about that, but that's where I think the exciting areas of developments are.
Just on that point, do you have to turn the business model upside down at NVIDIA to be able to attack those markets because those chips are going to sell for so much less than, say, the PC or workstation chips have in the past?
Yeah, we're in a pretty price competitive marketplace as it is. You know, there are no industries that I know of that is as cannibalistic of technology. You know, and read that into price erosion and competitive pricing as the PC industry. We are more aggressive about attacking each other and driving down our own costs than just about any other industry. And so we're familiar with the business model. It is true, though, that these devices tend to be very inexpensive, and so the silicon content will be much less per device. But you're going to have a lot more devices. Mm-hmm. The things that are challenging, though, is that because it takes 2 or 3 years to build a semiconductor device, and most of these markets develop overnight, mm-hmm. and they develop either by accident or through combinations of things, it is harder and harder for semiconductor companies, unless you think deeply about the consumer themselves and the end markets themselves, for you to build a chip that somebody's going to want to buy when the time comes. You know, a lot of these markets are a bit accidental, if you will. They're a bit combination, if you will. You know, something happened and then something else happened and then two or three things happened beyond that and boom, a new market shows up, like blogging,
right.
Like
or
podcasting.
Or partnership related. Do you find very many companies coming to you and saying, we've got this great idea, we've got a design, but we need this chip?
Well, we're seeing all kinds of examples like that. And what they're really clamoring for is computing technology with digital media processing, mm-hmm. which serves this intersection. Sony is that perfect example, right? I think, Kutaragi-san approached us about building the PlayStation 3 when after all of these years, IBM and Toshiba and Sony weren't able to build the synthesizer, reality synthesizer for the PlayStation 3. They're looking for a company who's able to do something like that and, you know, build a computer with multimedia technology at that intersection. Mm-hmm. And so that's a good example. There are many, many other examples that we're seeing today.
You talked a little bit earlier about Moore's Law being your friend in 3D, mm-hmm. being the enemy of some of these other markets. When you think, I guess, media processing, in the case of the PlayStation 3, clearly includes 3D.
Yeah.
If you look at video, which is another area where, you know, finally since NTSC is not the only game in town, there's some sort of performance curve to decline.
Yeah.
How do you view Moore's Law in that market? Is it your friend or your enemy?
There are very, very few technologies that I know of that Moore's Law is a friend of for anything more than 5 years to a decade. Mm-hmm. High-definition video is, by definition, already done. You know, we're demonstrating it today, which means that it'll be free tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And there's a high-definition video, Blu-ray disc. You know, the processing capability is 30 times more than standard definition. But once we show the first implementation to the world, and we recently did, and we're the first company in the PC industry to bring the whole solution together, from all the content protection to all the encryption to all of the processing and the software involved. And it was a lot of heavy lifting. But once you show evidence one, from that point forward, it's making it a little bit better, and it's about cost reduction. And as soon as that happens, you know, Moore's Law is going to drive it to approximately zero shortly. The exciting part of multimedia processing, I think, is going to happen on the handset. That's where essentially we've been, you know, propelled back 10 years. And so there's only so much transistors you could put in a cell phone handheld device. And so for about, you know, 5-10 years, we're going to have some really interesting opportunities in handsets. We're in three of the four TV trials for handsets. You know, this digital television on a handheld device.
So are those DVB-H?
DVB-H, yeah. And the experience is fabulous, and we put the video processing inside a GPU. So we're gonna see some pretty extraordinary opportunities in the handset device. You know, this is what I believe to be NVIDIA's second big opportunity. You know, the first one was personal computers and game consoles and such. This particular opportunity is going to be, it's going to put a computer in everybody's hands. And I think that today, it goes without saying that when we see a computer in somebody's hands, it is very unlikely that it is of the capability and all of the features and all the services that we imagine is possible on a PC. But yet in 10 years, we're going to imagine all of the same services and all of the same capabilities and all of the same, you know, functionality that you've seen a PC, except it's in a different form factor. It won't be called a PC. It won't be thought of as a PC. It won't have a keyboard, probably. But it's going to have all kinds of wonderful capabilities just like the PC. And so between now and 10 years from now, it's going to be some pretty exciting opportunities for us as we build GPUs for this market. I think this is going to be a fabulous, fabulous opportunity.
Something like the Trio display. Yep. What kinds of things do you think are going to be happening there 5 years out? I mean, is it going to be a rich 3D gaming experience? Are there going to be types of simulations, like e-commerce simulations that we don't think of, that are just really fun to buy things on? Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on how that platform is going to evolve?
You know, my guess is that, first of all, the capability is all going to be there. We'll use it in different ways. Mm-hmm. Digital television will be indigenous. Video players will be capable. Music players, obviously, it's, you know, connected to broadband. It's all of that stuff is going to have accelerometers, so it could react to your gesture. It might even have stereoscopic displays, so that you could see images floating literally on the surface of the phone. But those are all capabilities. My sense is that the applications people use will be much smaller in nature. Instead of applications, there'll be applets. Instead of movies, there'll be movelets or something. Really, just to show you previews and get you engaged into some service or buying something. I think those capabilities are just going to enable a bunch of services more than it's going to enable a bunch of applications per se. That we're not going to sit in front of that cell phone and do something for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. But as a service enabler, I think it's just going to be amazing.
You mentioned that you're in three of the four TV trials today. So I presume somebody else is building a receiver, and you guys then process the bitstream out of the receiver.
That's right, exactly.
Integration must be a powerful pressure, especially in the cell phone market. So you either need to be the integrator or the integratee there. How do you see that unfolding?
Well, you know, I'm going to not think about, I understand that that dynamic exists and that tension is certainly there. Mm-hmm. I'm going to not worry about it for a few years. And the reason for that is because I believe for the next 5 years, the cell phone is going to move so fast and standards are going to come flying at it and capabilities are going to come flying at it that the GPU, standalone GPU, is going to be relevant for a good half a decade and probably more than that. And so for the next 5 years, I'm going to stay focused. I'm not going to worry about integration. I'm not going to worry about the baseband. I'm not going to worry about RF. I'm going to worry about advancing the multimedia capability inside the GPU. And at first, you know, people told me that I was foolish. I mean, 3 years ago when I first started this, they said, hey, look, you know, the cell phone's about making phone calls. You know, the first PC, people thought it was about replacing a typewriter. And sure, it types today. But nobody thinks of it as a typewriter replacement. Nobody's going to think of that cell phone as a phone in 5-10 years. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be the most archaic and moronic way to think about that handheld device. My children already don't think of the cell phone as a phone. You know, they think of it as a mm-hmm. personal computing device that, by the way, happens to make phone calls. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that perspective is here. 5 years ago, that perspective wouldn't have been possible. But that perspective is clearly here, and the capability is going to be here. And so I'm going to focus much, much more on just driving the multimedia capability of 3D and 3D graphics into these handset devices, add value to the devices and to customers who want it. We're not the right company to work with for all things. And so for the people who want, you know, to build rich devices, we're the company they can come work with. And so that's going to be my focus for a while.
I think that's smart. I just continue to be amazed at how long this is taking to play out. You know, I mean, back in the mid-90s, we were thinking, oh, well, multimedia is pretty well developed. It was just the beginning.
It was just beginning.
Totally the beginning.
That's
and
right.
You really need to take almost a 20 or 30 year perspective because the types of capabilities that you're enabling are so processor intensive.
That's right.
And the realism that can be shown is just going to, I think, blow our minds away in 5 or 10 years.
So, exactly right. And the standards are changing all the time. And, you know, digital media is one of the few areas in computing, in technology, where we can actually demonstrate to the end user that the new device or our new technology or our new product is actually better than the last one.
Right. Exactly. Now, speaking of, you know, to do all this, you need incredible technical talent. And mm-hmm. I noticed in your last annual report that you had bought companies or opened offices in Russia, China, and
India.
And so what is it that you're seeking there? And is what you're seeking what you've found so far? Or is there been new insights, both technically and market-wise? Mm-hmm. Are you thinking about them as... the first toehold in a big market like China or Russia, were you looking at it initially for the technical talent or both?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we are a bit of a laggard when it comes to expanding globally, mm-hmm. and you know my perspective on globalization is several things. Number one is you know we should put our workforce and we should tap into talent where it's most optimal. If there's a particular country where a particular skill is prevalent, we ought to set up office there if we need that skill. And so we should think about the world as you know one small place, and not worry about their geographies and just optimize the placement of the talent. For the first 10 years of our company's history, the most optimal place was Silicon Valley. Because we had many management challenges as it is. We have many leadership challenges as it is. You know, just because Business Week thinks that India is 10 times cheaper doesn't mean that our management team can actually manage people over there. And so the optimal place was here, the most you know, success-oriented model would be here. And so we decided to invest here for a very long period of time. Over the years, all of us got a little bit better at managing, and all of us had developed better leadership skills, and we have more leaders in the company, and it was really time for us to scale out. And so we went to India, went to China, and depending on the indigenous engineering capability, we would optimize putting our workforce in those areas. The second reason is global sensibility. You know, I think that it is extremely arrogant to believe that we can build products here in Silicon Valley and people would love buying it in India. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, we only believe that because we don't get it. And in order to get it, you have to be there. And, you know, more of my time these days I spend traveling. It's, you know, back in the good old days, of course, you're here in Silicon Valley all the time because your customers are all here. And if your customers aren't here, they're in Texas. These days, you know, there are no customers here, and all of and so, right? There are no customers here, and you know, and Texas is just one of the few places that we go to. And so you have to have global sensibility. You have to understand what is their culture and what's important to them, and how do they think about buying products, and what state is the economy of that country. You know, China is at a very different state than India is, and Russia is in a very different state than either one of them, and Brazil is in a very different state. And so, you know, what is the state of their economy, and what would therefore people think about, and how would they perceive the products that we build? Mm-hmm. And what can we build, you know, optimally for them? And so I think that those are the two reasons, optimizing the global workforce, and then the second one is global sensibility. The challenge, of course, is cultural. You know, our employees in India and our employees in China have very different psychology and think differently than the people here in Silicon Valley. You know, I think here, let's just use some examples. I mean, in the United States, if you feel the answer is no, then the answer is no. You say no. If the answer is yes, you say yes. In Japan, you know, nobody says no. You just say, you know, very difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And nobody, no. You gotta
very difficult.
and nobody would ever say yes.
Yeah.
Right? And hang it out there too far. They would just say, make best effort, do my best. Mm-hmm. Right? And so every culture has its own way of communicating. India is the same way, and China is the same way. Mm-hmm. And they think about authority different, they think about organizations differently. And we have to be thoughtful about these things. Mm-hmm. They're challenging things.
I wouldn't guess that you have a lot of time for outside interests, but I saw that you're on the board of the RAND Corporation. What can you tell us about that?
As a policy, none of our executives can serve on the board of another technology company. And the reason for that is partly we should be working on this. And then partly because we believe that over time we don't want to put ourselves in a situation where we might have a perceived or actual conflict of interest. And so I've stayed out of boards, all boards. I've declined all boards and all outside activities with the exception of NVIDIA. But when the RAND folks came and talked to me about their mission and what they do, you know, this is an extraordinary institution, and it's a great privilege to be part of it and to be thinking about some of the deepest social and economic and global issues and making an attempt to provide a perspective on it through analysis is quite remarkable. And so I was very curious by it. What I've discovered is that they are quite remarkable, and these are incredible people and incredible institution. I wish I could do more for them and do more with them, but it's just very, very hard to run a company and to be engaged in something like that. Yeah, but I've loved every minute I've spent with them.
Jensen, we'll wrap up now, but as a final question, maybe we can ask you if you have any words of wisdom for entrepreneurs that are starting out today. A lot of our audience is global would-be entrepreneurs from some of the markets we were just talking about, like China, Russia, et cetera, that can go on the internet and listen to some of the things you've had to say. If you were starting a company today, or if you were thinking about an idea, what final thoughts might you have for them?
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of, you know, there was once there was a conference, and there were two keynote speakers. One of them was a video gamer, and he was in his teens, and he's just started an internet company. And the other keynote was Gates. Mm. And so they asked Gates, you know, what advice would you give to that? His name was Dennis Fong. And he's the best Quake player in the world there for a while. And Gates had a remarkable thing. I thought he said it perfectly. He says, you know, when I was Dennis's age, I didn't want anybody else's advice. and I thought it made perfect sense. You know, I think the one of the greatest assets of an entrepreneur is they don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. If I knew then what I know now, I'm not sure I'd do it. Because you just know how hard it was. And although many people have great confidence, you know, in themselves and the people they work with, and I do, the extraordinary effort it takes to build and run a company is beyond words can possibly put down. Mm-hmm. And I know that running a business is partly skill, but building a company is a lot about heart as well. And you have to decide to give of yourself in a way that no books can teach you. And so I think that I could say what helped me maybe as a way of thinking through that. It helped me to believe deeply in what we were trying to do. It helped me to think about building a great company instead of thinking about taking the company public or thinking about building a great product or you know, the company has to have many of those things, but to put your mind in the right place was important to me. Mm-hmm. And it helps you deal with setbacks. It helped me to realize that making mistakes is part of building a company and part of being successful, and it's part of innovation. And to celebrate our mistakes is something that I thought was... you know, unfortunately, as Mike remembers, we made so many mistakes. Unless you celebrated it, we'd be pretty bummed out a lot at the time. But we were thoughtful about thinking about how to think about our mistakes, and what the roles the mistakes played in the building of our company, and in the building of our culture, and made it possible for us to see through all of that, and have the patience for it. I couldn't explain the word culture when we first started the company, and I can tell you now it's probably the most important thing. And so I think that entrepreneurs start out by having a business idea or a technology idea or product idea, but don't underestimate the importance of you know, the company's personality and the company's character. It is really important to start that as soon as you can. I had the benefit of through adversity. And through having worked with a lot of great people here, the culture sort of developed on its own in the beginning. And I realized, you know, at the right time and sufficiently early enough that I had to go and perpetuate it, and it was my job to be the custodian of the culture. It was a good insight and a good perspective, again, early on in my career as a CEO, and I think that helped me. Mm-hmm. So these things are helpful for entrepreneurs.
Great.
Jensen, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Mike. It's good to see you.
Likewise.
Thank you, Jensen.
Thanks.
Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks, bud.